You're listening to a special edition of Bad Intonation. My name is Michael Elves, UMFM program director, and this is the last in a series of three takeovers for Chops Talks, a series of conversations with artists playing the 2018 TD Winnipeg International Jazz Festival. You can check out past interviews on SoundCloud/UMFM1015. And coming up today, we're going to be talking to three great artists. And we're going to be talking to Nick Blacka of Go Go Penguin, to Dan Weiss of Dan Weiss's Stair Baby, and to Michael Casehammer, Canadian jazz legend. He's coming up in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to start things off with Ellen Doty, who is playing tonight at Kitchen Sink. 6 p.m. dinner seating, I believe, is sold out, and then a 9 p.m. cocktail seating. There are still tickets, so far as I know. Go check her out. Great Canadian jazz vocalist. We're going to hear a track called I Fall For You Again from her 2014 record, Gold. All right. Well, pianist Michael Kayshammer's latest is something new. He'll be bringing it to the Jazz Winnipeg Festival Saturday, June 23rd at Knox United Church, and he joins us on the line now. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Now, Good. This record, I have to ask in terms of how you assembled all the people that you got to participate in this record. Like, was it simply a matter of like, hey, do you want to do this? Or like, what's the approach to get this many guests and participants?
Yeah, it all kind of started with the rhythm section and the core group of the record. And basically, I went into it with the thought, who do I want to play with? Who do I want to have on the record? And for me, friends and people you get along with is one of the biggest criteria. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're great players should be a given. And I wanted to do it in New Orleans with some of my favorite rhythm section players, some of my favorite bass players, some of my favorite drummers, percussionists. And that's how it started. And then it basically, the other guests who are soloists or vocalists, that just kind of fell into place since I self-produced it, by sitting in the control room and thinking, you know who would sound great on this is Cyril Neville or, I don't know, whoever. And just calling him and saying, hey, you want to come over and record? And I've never had more fun doing a record because I had zero thought about what anyone else thinks. It was really just, how do I want to make a record?
So, sitting behind the boards as the producer and kind of reevaluating your performance or your music and the recordings, like, are you able to put on a different hat and look objectively at what you've recorded? Like, how do you kind of like compartmentalize or reconcile the two things?
Well, that is where self-producing can go wrong a lot of times, is exactly what you were saying. And maybe 10, 15 years ago, it would have gone wrong for me too. But at this point where I'm at, you know, I love playing piano more than anything, and I love it more than I ever have, and singing and writing, being the artist. But the producing part of it is almost as enjoyable for me if it's my own music or someone else's music. And so I'm able at this point to put that different hat on, because you have to be... you have to be honest with yourself. And I think maybe age has something to do with it, maybe lifestyle, but I think it's just what you have to be honest with yourself throughout the day, even if it has nothing to do with music. And you have to get to a point where that is how you live your life, where you don't really, you know, fool yourself by convincing yourself certain things are going on in your life that you're not honest about. And that's, if you translate it directly into the music, it's not that hard, actually. Because a lot of times when you're an artist, you think everything you do is great. But that's just not the case. And that's where self-producing can go wrong. But I think I'm at a point where I can tell myself, yeah, that really isn't so good, Michael.
So you said that you like producing almost as much as piano playing. What is it about producing that you glom onto?
Well, it's kind of like, it feels like you can shape music and sound in your mind and then translate it and see if you can actually put it on record, what you've imagined and what you've seen in your mind. I imagine being a conductor and having a symphony orchestra in front of you and shaping music through other people that way would be a very similar experience, and must be an amazing experience. But that's kind of what I love about it. I wouldn't say I love it more, but it's you can get inside the music more from that angle rather than just being there and playing.
So is it like a deeper level of like the same thing with songwriting, where you hear a song in your head and then how you realize it?
Yeah, it's very similar. It's just you're instead of hearing melodies or hearing lyrics or subject matter, you're just hearing the overall soundscape and what it should sound like, and how do you get there?
Right. So did you take like different approaches for each different song? I mean, because there's a variety of participants and sounds on this record. Like, is the approach uniform for you as producer, or is it like you tailor it to whomever is involved on that particular track?
No, it's, for me, it's uniform in the way that it's all about getting the honesty out of someone's performance, meaning really just hiring the right people for the right track and not trying to make someone do something that might not be their thing, or that even if it's outside someone's comfort zone, even if someone who usually plays rock all of a sudden is on a jazz track, it really just, it doesn't matter. Music's music, and it really just matters that you make that person feel comfortable by letting them know that you really just want them, their personality and their playing, and it doesn't have to be something, anything else, you know, like it doesn't have to be, that's the only way to get a great performance out of anyone.
So as producer, are you kind of like a coach with like a locker room talk sometimes with the artists, like, you know, motivating them and kind of cajoling them?
I think the stuff you don't say is where it's at, because as soon as you go in and you tell someone what to do, their brain works a certain way of, are they accomplishing what the producer needs? Are they doing a good job? Doesn't matter who it is. That's just human behavior. And I think it's just, if what you don't say and how you make people feel just personally, just, you know, one human being across from another human being, just how you make them feel in the room. I think that's kind of where it's at.
Is that something?
And there's different ways of producing, and this is just what I think works for me.
Is it something you've gleaned from working with other producers that, you know, they've maybe told you to go a certain way and then your reaction is predicated on that?
I think a lot of things, how I approach my music and my business and my touring is actually from experiences from the past, and not just always the good ones, but exactly that is that you might have been, or I might have been in a situation where afterwards I realized, yeah, that just didn't work, and I know why it didn't work, and maybe I should have trusted my gut instead of following someone else's thoughts. And so there's a lot of trust within yourself that you just trust that you know what's best, you know. And that has nothing to do with ego. That's really just you know what you're good at.
Experience and self-assuredness.
Yeah, and then this has also got me to the point of wanting to produce more other people's music a little bit, you know, and because it's just, it's super fun.
So how do you go about like finding opportunities to do that? Like, are you contacting certain artists that you'd like to work with, or like kind of putting feelers out, or how do you kind of?
Yeah. The reason why I called the record Something New is because that was my new approach to doing this record. I thought it might be fun to just start it with my own and start producing some other people, some vocalists and then this is kind of what you have to do. I don't really have a huge track record of producing other people because it's not been what I've, you know, what I spent my time with, although I've done a couple of them, records that I've done okay or have done well, but I'm not known as a producer producing other people's music. So it's just like any business, you have to kind of promote yourself, quote unquote, by approaching other people, maybe someone who you really like, or maybe you hear something about in someone else's music and you go, hey, what do you think of this? And if there's ever an opportunity, maybe we can work together.
So when you say hear something else in someone's music, like, are you going to a lot of live shows or listening to a lot of like existing records, or what are you searching for?
I just let it come towards me. I don't really search for it. When I listen to records, I usually have a huge record collection, vinyl collection from the time when I grew up, and I find myself listening through that collection rather than a lot of new music. New music I really just listen to, you know, Spotify or something in the car. But I'm not really looking, but there's always things that kind of pop up, or you think of an artist and you go, you know what would sound great if this person would do this, or, and the artist might not be really into that kind of a thing, and that's fine. But it could be that there's a situation where it kind of you know, the artist is ready to do something that they might not think of, and I might have thought of something, and then it's the good. It just has to grow organically out of that.
Right.
So I think I'm going to work on a couple of projects sometime this year and see what comes out of it. Like, one of the singers on this record, Curtis Salgado, who's a great blues singer from Portland. I played in Portland, and because he sang a song on the record, I asked him to come on stage and sing the song, and then we just hung out afterwards, and something came out of that. And so that's kind of, you know, how you come up with concepts.
Right. The fact that you recorded in New Orleans, was that like an intentional decision because of kind of like the sound of the city, or a specific like recording studio that you wanted to work in? Like, how did you arrive at that?
Everything I grew up listening to as a kid was jazz from New Orleans through my dad's record collection. And I love New Orleans, and I lived down there for a little while before Katrina. And to me, that whole second line rhythm and that whole kind of drumming and piano playing coming from New Orleans is what really turns my crank. This is what I love in jazz. And so, you know, there's a couple of ways to go about it. I have friends who are musicians there, so I could either go there where actually the sound is, or I could try and recreate it in some studio in Toronto or something. And I just didn't see the point in that, and I just went there.
And did it make it easier to get a few folks into the studio if they were like in town?
Absolutely. I mean, and you have different ideas. If I would have recorded it in Toronto, I might have thought of different people to sing certain songs. But that's the other, you know, you have to be kind of in the moment and open to what comes your way. So if you're sitting in New Orleans, or if you're sitting in Toronto or in Winnipeg in a studio, you want to get that feeling into the record. So picking people who are close by and the spontaneity of it, or the food that you eat, like everything comes in how you feel and how you record. And I just wanted that certain sound, so I went there.
So you kind of take like a holistic approach to your music making then, it sounds like. Even your diet impacts it.
You know, that's... If it doesn't have that kind of connection with other things in my life, then I'm not really interested to record, to be honest with you. Like, it has to be more than just, here's a bunch of songs, let's record them because we need a new record.
So then, in terms of the songs on the record, was there stuff that didn't make the cut just because it didn't have the connection or, like, fit within the larger picture?
Yeah. I wrote all those songs when I was on the road and China the previous year, and I just kind of wrote about impressions and thoughts I had on traveling in, you know, different areas than what I'm used to living in. And there's definitely some stuff that either wasn't relevant anymore, subject matter wasn't relevant anymore, or the song just wasn't good enough. And that's important too, is that you realize that, you know, not everything you write is up for it. You know, some songs might be great live, but doesn't mean they're great on record, and just the other way around. And for me, it's also important to bounce ideas off friends and family, and usually they're people who have nothing to do with music, who don't play an instrument, but who actually just listen to music and either like it or don't. I think that's a very important criteria and feedback to get. Because musicians listen to it one way, but then the people who actually, you know, what music is about is a little bit more subconscious, not so brain-oriented.
Right, that they're coming at it from a layperson's perspective.
Yeah. And that's really, when you think about it, that's what music is about, is to bring people together. And it's not about listening to it and figuring out with the brain what someone does in that music. That's maybe greatly to get to the music, but then that's not the purpose of it.
Sure enough. I want to get you to pick something off of the record that we can feature for listeners. And if you have a reason why you're picking it or an anecdote about the song, I'd love to hear that.
Well, why don't we just pick the song with Curtis, since we just talked about that. Do You Believe? I started to write the songs from a different angle. I called Johnny, who is the drummer on the record, Johnny Vidakovich. And he's one of my favorite drummers. He used to play on all the Professor Longhair James Booker albums back in the day. And I said to him, record a bunch of grooves, and then I will take them with me to China, and I'll write songs on top of some of these grooves and edit your grooves and just, you know, write songs on top of rhythm rather than coming at it from a melodic point. And this track was kind of one of the first that I used, and you can hear it on the track. And then the song is all about what we just talked about. It's really just, what is it you want to do with your life, and how do you want to record music, or how do you want to live your day-to-day life, and do you do it the way you want it to, or are you, you know, are you doing it because your job or your environment is telling you something else to do? Just really staying true to yourself.
All right, well, we'll give that one a listen. Saturday, June 23rd at Knox United Church as part of the Winnipeg Jazz Festival. Michael, thanks very much for taking some time, and safe travels in the interim.
Thanks for the chat. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
You down and out. How do you find redemption if you fear it? When you hide your heart behind a wall of doubt. How do you put your faith in someone who will lie and cheat just to get their way? The past is the sign of what is coming. Gotta make a better world today. Set out to be, or did you kiss your sweetest dreams goodbye? Do you believe you can live all your fantasy? Spread your wings, take to the sky. Maybe I'm not your cup of tea. Don't care if you breathe, push, come to shove. No matter what anyone tries to be, without love, we'll never have enough. Oh, yeah. Do you believe, that you can reach where you set out to be? Or did you kiss your sweetest dreams goodbye? Do you believe, you can imagine, you can see? Nothing you can't conquer if you try. What does it really mean to be rich or poor, hip or lazy? Why is it all about to stand out in a crowd when one day all the stars burn out? When one day they burn out.
All right. Well, coming to the Jazz Winnipeg Festival Saturday, June 23rd, playing Old Market Square at 9:15 p.m. Pardon me, not in the morning. Dan Weiss, who brings his quintet and his record Stair Baby. He joins us on the phone. How are you doing, Dan?
Good. I'm doing good. Thanks, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So the album is called Stair Baby, but the way that they've listed it in the Jazz Festival program, is it the project also called Stair Baby too? It's like Dan Weiss Stair Baby?
Yeah, the project is called Stair Baby.
So
yeah, that's the name of the group.
Okay. So I'm curious, first of all, where that name came from.
Okay. Well, me and, you know, my friend Miles Okazaki, familiar with his work?
Yep.
Yeah, so we're very good friends, and our families were at the beach one day, and I had a newborn daughter at the time, and she was about 10 months at the time, and Miles' son, who was an 8-year-old, you got a stare baby, that's what he said. He referred to my baby because she's very curious. She's very always, you know, trying to assess the situation. So it actually came from that, Miles' son, and the name stuck.
Right.
And it felt like it fit the music. Took a long time to come up with that, to settle on that title, but in the end, it felt like it was the right move.
Is it the sort of curiosity and intense glare? Is that kind of like the tone that your baby sets that also this project represents?
Does that? Yeah, there's definitely some of that. Yeah, that sums it up.
Right.
Yeah, it's an intense glare, and definitely intense. Definitely curious. Yeah, that's pretty good.
So in terms of putting this project together, because this follows like a couple of other, I would say, like different things, right? 14 and 16 were mm-hmm. much different pieces. Was this something always in the back of your mind that you wanted to do this? Because as I understand it, like kind of your earliest drumming records were like Prague and like Zeppelin and stuff like that. And this seems to kind of be not necessarily like a pivot back towards that, but like an incorporation of some of like the heavy rock drumming.
Yeah. Yeah. The first stuff I ever listened to, I was exposed to from my father. He was a guitarist, you know, by hobby, not professional, but yeah, the first stuff I heard was Zeppelin and, you know, Hendrix and the Who, Cream, you know, stuff like that. And then later I got into you know, other progressive bands, you know, Rush and Yes and, you know, Crimson and Floyd and Gentle Giant. And then I got into some heavier stuff, different genres of metal. And then you know, when I was about 14, I got the jazz bug. But this group, yeah, we've been talking about it. I've been talking about it since about 2005 or 6 when I met Trevor, and I was doing a lot more playing with Craig back then, and we and Ben, so we were always talking about putting together, not always, but on a few occasions, talking about putting together a band, you know, just with a heavier sound and with coming from a heavier place. And then I met Matt in 2009, and we, you know, we had an instant the musical bond we had was super tight. So yeah, so it goes back a while. It goes back about 12 years, the idea of it.
Those conversations with like Craig and Trevor and stuff, like, did you guys discover like a shared affinity for like bands like Slayer or like heavier stuff, or like?
Yeah, there's definitely an affinity for a lot of bands. Yeah, we were all definitely fans of metal. I mean, Slayer, one of them, you know, Meshuggah, Gorguts, Cryptopsy. I mean, so many different bands that we realized that we like these bands. So obviously Trevor, you know, has played with some heavier acts. Bongo and, you know, all the stuff he's done with Patton and the Phantomas, you know, so mm-hmm. the Melvins. So he's got a foot in there already. So, and then Craig, Ben, and Matt are, you know, very very deep in too. So that's just, you know, one of the influences for this record. there's other stuff too. Obviously, we're drawing on everything that we like, but
right.
the sound and it's definitely a heavier sound, you know.
So you mentioned this is like 12 years back. You kind of started talking about this. What pushed it to the foreground? Like, was there some sort of like event or conversation that was like, let's actually do this?
Yeah, I was able to fortunately get a grant from the Shifting Foundation, and that was one of the projects that I pitched, and that's how really it came to fruition. You know, we got some very generous. I was able to get some funding from them,
mm-hmm.
and that really made it happen. Now we're doing some tours, and we got some momentum. And I'm already writing a second record for the group, so we're gonna try to record it in March of 2019.
So, yeah. So speaking of writing, let's talk about kind of the genesis of the material on the record. Like, are you writing sheets for the guys, or like what kind of process is things for you? Like, how fully formed are tracks before you bring them to the group, or you know, are you guys jamming at all, or how do you kind of develop tracks?
Yeah, well, I'm the writer, and from the very beginning of the project, and from the before I gave them any music, I said I'm really open to any input, any insight, anything you want to add to it. So I really wanted to not feel like a dictatorship, with like a lot of other bands. People bring in music for their band, and obviously they trust their band, and they have their band, and they're willing to go in different directions, but it's still, it's a little more cut and dry. This is the music. This is how it's supposed to be played. So there was more of finding things as we rehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's not to say that I didn't, write a lot of material and wrote for about 6 or 7 months. And, I sent the guys sound files and then, and sheet music at the same time so that they could hear at least the sense of what each piece sounded like. So there's definitely the written aspect was kept intact for the most part. But, when we got into rehearsing and doing some gigs, some stuff was taken out, some stuff was, embellished, some stuff was maybe, doubled by an instrument and then in the mixing process, we found some stuff like that, at the end of the tune, Bartolomenti, that was kind of in the studio. It was Craig's idea to do, piano. I don't know if you there's the track with the
I know the record front to back. So
okay, it's the tune that was going to originally end with arpeggiators, the synthesizer. So, but then it was Craig's idea. Why don't we play those lines on piano? And then I said, okay, cool. Why don't you play four piano four hands? And then so that was like a spontaneous thing in the studio. And then when we were mixing the record, we were playing with Ron St. Germain was the engineer, and so we were just experimenting with different fading points and lifting levels. So it was just some experimentation with that, especially with that track, how to end. So we faded the arpeggiators down and we faded the pianos up, and that's how the piece ended. So there was some of that, a lot of that actually in the mixing process. We found some of the architecture of the tunes, and so some of that has stuck in the live performances.
Mm.
Some of it hasn't, there's limitations,
right?
But some of it has stuck, like that droney part at the end of Annika, where we drone out like a long time. That was kind of found in the studio, and now we do that live, and we really, really stretch it. We go on for a while. So, yeah, it was a kind of a lot of different processes that happened.
So some of the building that you did in the studio then. For those that isn't, getting incorporated live, is it simply just kind of like technical difficulty of like accomplishing or recreating those moments in a live setting, like that something you're able to do with layering and engineering and sort of
some stuff. Some stuff, yeah, you're able to do, and some stuff is just left. Okay, this is the recording, and then the live thing is going to be something different, you know.
Right.
You know, like, for example, that tune, Bottle Mente, they're on the arpeggiators, right? So they're, Matt and Craig are both on the prophets, and they're doing the arpeggiator thing, the layering thing. And so for them to go to the piano, it would mean that the momentum would get broken. So we have that, you know, we have them stay there for the ending, whereas the record, you just hear piano. So some things, you know, we're not going to go out of our way to try to recreate the recording sound if it's going to, you know, mess up the continuity in a live performance.
Right.
We'll just leave both as they are.
Speaking of live performance, how do you build a set out of this record? Like, what kind of considerations do you take into in terms of, like, you know, what things to hit or, you know, how to sort of, like, build songs one into the next or tell a story? Like, what considerations are you considering?
Well, if we have one set, a lot of the times, you know, when I was putting together the record, a lot of different orders that set orders that it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
I originally wanted to start the record with Annika, which is a long tune.
Right.
Like maybe 9:40 or something like that. But then, you know, there's considerations, you know, grabbing the listener, having something punchy maybe in the beginning. To start the record. So there's different considerations. That works well as an opening tune, the Annika tune. It's a very slow build. It allows us to hear the room. It allows us to adjust to each other dynamically. And it kind of sets the vibe up. So that's an opener that we've been doing consistently from show to show. It works, you know, for the various reasons I just spoken about.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That makes a lot of sense to me because one of the things at times this record, feels like a doom record, and for me, like, doom is all about like tone and pace.
Totally.
And those are like kind of the two things that the band controls and takes the listener with them on, and Annika definitely like feels like doomish. Especially.
I was in a band called Bloody Panda for a couple of years, and they were just a straight-up doom band. So when I was playing with them, I got exposed to a lot of those groups, and I really, really liked that genre, you know. There's definitely a couple nods throughout the record to that kind of vibe. And but just having that space in the beginning lets us really feel each other out, feel the room out, and we're able to go from there. So that's a big consideration. You know, usually episode 8 is closing the record and it closes the show. So we kind of stick to the recording, actually, besides the first tune, you know.
Right.
It's pretty front to back, you know. We'll play the record. If we have two sets, that's a different story, you know. We'll stretch things out a little more. We'll play maybe four or five tunes. Maybe we'll repeat a couple tunes. You know.
Does the architecture of the songs allow you to kind of like stretch things out easily? Like, do you find that there's gaps or breathing space in the songs that you've written that allow you to kind of play with the pace?
Yeah, and as we played more, you know, I've decided to open a couple more things up, more than the record. So now, you know, as the tune Veiled starts with that the modular synth thing, now we start kind of collective improv. We go into the tune. You know, that's an example. We stretch on a few other things, more than the record. A couple tunes are pretty much as they are, and we're not going to change them. Like the first tune, Puncher's Chance, that's as is. So it's a short tune, and we keep the form like that. There's not really stretching in that.
Mm-hmm.
The second tune,
like a quick in and out track, so it maybe loses some of its efficacy if you do try to push
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and you want to keep some punch to some things, and you want to have some variety and pace, like you said, and length and intensities. If every tune's long, long tunes are going to lose their meaning, you know. So,
right,
I want to keep some of that intact. But yeah, there's definitely consideration. So if we're playing a live gig and we're playing two sets, maybe we'll stretch a couple tunes longer than we did if we played a one-set gig. You know, there's a couple two-set gigs coming up. There's a bunch of two-set gigs coming up on this tour. So we'll figure that out. We haven't done that yet. We've only done one set, which is actually a lot more conducive for this so far. You know, we have one recording, so
right.
One set's perfect, but we'll figure it out in the two set then.
Before we go, Dan, I want to get you to pick a track off the record that we can play for listeners, and if you have a reason why you're picking that song in particular or an anecdote about it, I'd love to hear that.
How much time you got?
Whatever you want.
Let's do episode 8.
Okay, album closer.
Episode 8, the album closer, that comes from, I was heavily into... I still am, but Twin Peaks, and especially this last season,
the
return
iteration.
Season.
Yeah.
So that episode really, you know, I was doing a lot of writing around that time. Twin Peaks, it started in May of 17. I think May, and then, you know, me and my wife will watch it. Matt Mitchell will come over every weekend with his girlfriend, and we watch it. And so that there's a lot of... the show really influenced me in the writing process, and especially that episode, which blew me away and never seen anything like it. So I try to capture some of that world, you know, in that tune.
Right.
Yeah.
I knew you had a track named Battle Lamenti. I didn't know you, the episode 8 was specifically named after that episode.
Yeah,
that makes sense
that.
Now.
That
That's. Certainly.
Yeah, so, you know, Lynch, he juxtaposes those two worlds, you know, in a lot of his work. That he's got the dark underbelly, and he's got this kind of soap opera-ish thing, and it's something that I thought about when I was writing.
Perfect.
How to juxtapose two different kind of sound worlds.
Awesome. Well, Dan, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about the project, and looking forward to seeing you at the Winnipeg Jazz Festival, man.
Oh, my pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you. I hope you guys enjoy it.
All right. Well, Manchester trio Go-Go Penguin coming to the Winnipeg International Jazz Festival in support of A Humdrum Star, their latest record. Bassist Nick Black joins me by phone. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So I want to talk a little bit about this record and then kind of back the train up to talk about kind of the band's history as well. Was there any difference in terms of approach to recording this record than in previous efforts, or is it kind of just a continuation of kind of the path that you guys have been on for a while?
I guess it's a continuation of where we've been in terms of that we were using the same team where we always use Joe Reiser, who's our live sound engineer. He's like the fourth member of the band. He also records the albums and he co-produces with a guy called Brendan Williams, who so they've been with us since V2.0. So in terms of going in and recording, it kind of feels the same. It was a little bit different actually because this is the first time we've recorded in Manchester. We recorded it at the old Granada Studios, which is an old television studios that isn't in use anymore, and it's a great studio that Brendan's got access to. So in terms of the team going in, it's kind of the same, but we had a bit more time this time, and I think we approached it maybe we're a little bit more experimental in terms of arrangements and maybe just a little bit more, perhaps a bit more daring with certain aspects of making it.
Was there, like, simply just because of access to Granada that you decided to record in Manchester, or had you guys hoped to kind of do it closer to home rather than having to travel to a studio?
Well, when we first did V2.0, it was all very exciting to get away, and, you know, we'd never really been touring or anything before, so we did those V2.0 and Man-Made Objects. We did in a residential studio in Wales where we got to stay over, and it was out in the countryside and it was beautiful. But because since then we've done so much touring, we've gone around the world and everything, I think the idea of being in Manchester was very appealing just because we're never here anymore. So just to, even to leave the studio for, you know, 7-8 hours to get some sleep, just to get out of the madness and recharge and then come back was quite an appealing thing for us.
Yeah, I have to ask, in terms of creatively, is it better for you to have, like, the routine of, you know, going back to your own bed and stuff like that versus kind of that, like, pressure cooker of being away and having, like, a limited time in a studio? Does that change things dynamically?
I think it was just really necessary this time around. I mean, we spend so much time together. We don't really get to see a lot of friends and family anymore because we do so much touring, so this time around it was much better for us creatively. In the past, it was great to just isolate ourselves, think, right, we're going to go make a record, so we're going to be shut off from the world and do that. But for this one, definitely, I think it was good that we were back in Manchester.
Now, you mentioned that both you and Joe came on for V2.0. Obviously, there was a record prior to that. When Joe came on, did he come on as, like, live sound engineer and recorder, like engineer co-producer at the time, or did he just come on as, like, the live sound engineer and then in the recording process it became something that he took on? Like, was it identified from the start that these were both his roles?
No, it wasn't actually. I don't think so anyway, not as far as I'm aware. I think his role sort of developed and grew into the what he is now, which is he is the fourth member of the band, and he's so integral to every aspect of it because he does the tour managing as well. But at the time, I think they actually got him on board, obviously just to do the live sound, because we joined at the same time, me and Joe. So
right.
They needed, you know, the idea was to get a better sort of live sound, and also just amplifying the double bass. They were struggling a little bit with the old bass player. And then when he left, I came in and Joe was there, and he was just the live sound engineer, but when it came to make the album, it was just, he was the guy that stepped up to do it, and he's been doing it ever since and getting better for every record, I think.
Now, producer can kind of mean a few different things depending on, you know, the person in the chair and the relationship with the band. Like, how much of a a stamp on the arrangements or the sound does Joe have, or is he like just kind of trying to get the ideal recording sound for you? What's his role?
It's a bit of both. I mean, he knows us so well. Like when we first started getting together, he was there for a lot of the rehearsals. And when we do the, like when we're writing tunes or coming up with arrangements, he's still there. So he's actually the guy you can say, sometimes we think we've got it in the studio and think, all right, we've nailed it. And he says, you haven't got it, which isn't always the easiest thing to hear. But yeah, he kind of plays that role for us. So, I mean, him and Brendan do it. Brendan's co-producer. He's really good. He like lectures at one of the universities in Manchester in sound recording, and he just knows us so well as well. So I think it's the fact that they know what our strengths are, and they can speak to us honestly and openly about things, which is good.
Do you guys road test material before heading into the studio?
We did for this album. It was the first time we've ever really. I mean, sometimes there's the odd tune here and there where, you know, like it's maybe been written a bit before the rest of the album, so it gets thrown into the set before the album comes out. But for this one, we actually put some little small secret shows in London. I think we did 3 nights in just a small space. It's called Echoes, I think, in Shoreditch in London. And it was invite only for people who were coming to who'd already bought tickets to some of our bigger gigs. And it was good, actually. It was a bit nerve-wracking because we couldn't really play the tunes, but we got the opportunity to try them for a live audience for the first time.
So I have to imagine coming out of that, then Joe is able to definitely say, like, you have it or you don't have it when you're in the studio because he's seen these songs live.
Yeah, absolutely. It's. I mean, like, he gets to see, like, we're all there playing every night, but he gets to see it, like, slightly from the outside. And so he probably has a better idea than sometimes we do.
He has kind of the, like, editorial eye that, you know, he's not quite as close to the writing of the material.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So in terms of the songs on A Humdrum Star, as I understand it, your writing process kind of varies from track to track, that you guys sometimes you'll bring in a bass loop for folks, sometimes there'll be, you know, kind of a drum pattern or like a jam coming out. Like, was that atypical for you, like in terms of A Humdrum Star? Like, that's, you know, it's a mishmash of writing styles and sort of births of different songs.
Yeah, it kind of gets glued together sometimes. You know, like one idea will come from somewhere and then another idea will come from another person and we'll kind of work them in together. I mean, sometimes it's a more fully formed idea that's on a logic project, or other times it's just like, well, I've got this set of chords and then we add stuff to it and it kind of forms out of that. But we always get in a room together, the three of us, to really everybody to put their mark on it. And sometimes it happens very quickly, and other times we might be looping, you know, 4 bars for a day and feel like we're not getting anywhere with it and where's the tune going to go, and then one day it'll just click. But some of them come together very quickly, but yeah, sometimes it's quite laborious.
Are there times where you kind of end up abandoning an idea just because you can't seem to circle a square?
Yeah. There's a few like that hasn't quite come to fruition. It's very weird making an album because when you first start out, you kind of have an idea of what it's going to be, but it never can really fully grasp what the complete thing is going to be. And sometimes when we're working on stuff, I have this vision that this track's going to be really big and then it'll end up being a bonus track or vice versa, or it doesn't make it onto the album because we didn't quite get there with it. And it's quite interesting, actually. But there's a few that little ideas and stuff that are still floating around that haven't fully formed into what they're supposed to be yet.
So at what point do you know that you're done with A, with a song, but B, with like the record as it's going to be, you know, released to the world?
Well, with the record, it's usually just time constraints.
Right.
I mean, I think if we didn't have them, we'd probably take a bit more time and maybe we'd never let it go, so it might be a good thing to have deadlines. I mean, you're never fully satisfied with an album, but you've got to sort of have an idea of when it's time to let go and move on. Some songs, I don't know, I mean, like, when we get out there and start playing them live, it's one of those sort of, it's a bit bittersweet because you've already recorded it and then it starts coming together and then you start thinking, oh, I could have done this on this track and whatever, but it's already been recorded for the album, so gotcha. You just have to let go at some point.
Right. So I read an interview that said that you got into the bass because it was like a friend's brother's band you saw and you were like drawn to the bass guitar. I mean, that makes perfect sense. You know, as a kid, you see something and you kind of want to emulate it, but that doesn't necessarily lead to the double bass and, you know, playing upright bass. If you saw, you know, like a bass guitarist in a rock band or something, how did you end up, you know, in lugging around this giant upright bass?
I don't know. I keep asking myself that. Well, it was just a progression thing. So I started playing like sort of indie covers and typical Manchester sort of stuff on the bass guitar. And then I just became obsessed with it, practiced all the time, started discovering different types of music, like, you know, 60s and then funk and a bit of jazz. And then I went to study for A-level music and I had a really good bass teacher at the time. And he played double bass and he was a jazz double bassist. So he got me more interested in that approach. And then I started seeing double bass sort of like featured. I didn't really know too much about like a lot of straight ahead jazz, but there was quite a big crossover thing that I kept seeing, you know, like where jazz players were playing with hip hop artists or like the late 90s sort of drum and bass thing. And my bass teacher, my second bass teacher, was double bassist for a group called Lamb, who were...
Oh, yeah, no, I know Lamb, yeah.
Yeah, so, and that was quite inspiring to me because he was, like, doing small jazz gigs around Manchester, but then, like, going off and playing, like, Glastonbury and doing things on the radio with Lamb, and it was like, wow, you know, just that, the scope for this old instrument that you can take it and play jazz and straight ahead stuff, but it's still been used in modern music and for breakbeats and drums, and you know, that's kind of what inspired me really.
Did you catch Finger Thing when you were younger?
Finger Thing, yeah, I know Sneaky. Yeah,
because I was gonna say that's a UK, that's a Manchester act that, you know, has an upright bassist and blends electronic and jazz and stuff like that, so.
Yeah, well, they used to be signed to a label called Grand Central Records, which is now defunct in Manchester. But for a while, it was a really cool label. And there was another artist on there called AIM. And he put together a live band. And I used to play the bass in his live band. He was like a hip-hop kind of producer, DJ kind of thing. So he shared a label with Finger Thing.
Yeah, trying to think what the records were that AIM. Cold Water Music, is that the one?
Cold Water Music, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. So it was a little bit before my time in terms of like me being in that band, but then when he did the third album, Flight 602, I was in the live band for that.
You were in the live band for that. I know in reading a couple interviews that you were talking about kind of like different influences and that, you know, you guys get kind of pushed into the jazz category, but that you often cite a lot of like more electronic artists like Aphex Twin and John Hopkins Fortet.
Yeah.
Is that kind of like, were those kind of more the foundational artists for you, were in the electronic vein, but electronic artists who really kind of push at the edges of like live instrumentation or arrangement or composition?
Well, I think what's inspiring about the electronica artists, that like people like John Hopkins and Aphex Twin and everything, it's just, I don't know, it's like they sort of occupy a world that there's no rules, but it's still very inspiring because it's almost like anything's possible with the technology. Like if you say you're a jazz band, this is sort of why we try and get away from the jazz band thing a little bit, because people then expect a certain thing from you, which you're not necessarily going to get from us. You know, like, we're not going to do a big unaccompanied bass solo, although we do some of that actually, but, you know, like, and then the drums play fours and all that stuff. It's more like we're more interested in trying to create a different sound world, and a lot of that inspiration comes from electronica and these artists, and there's no real established set of rules. If you want to try and make something, then that's what you can do, and it's just quite inspirational.
There does seem to be like a reemergence of British jazz, though. Like, I mean, I know like stuff like Shabaka and the Ancestors and Sons of Kemet and Yaz Ahmed and stuff like that. Are you guys kind of in touch with or part of that community, or do you kind of stand aside of that?
We're not really, like, I mean, obviously we know those guys, and we know Shabaka. We've met him a few times, just generally on gigs, and we went out and played South by Southwest in America, and a lot of those guys were there. But I guess maybe because we're in Manchester, we're slightly out on our own a little bit.
Right.
But yeah, we know about those guys.
The one jazz act that I really do feel there's like a kindred spirit to is Esbjørn Svendsen Trio. That, like, listening to the new record, A Humdrum Star, like, very much so, a couple times I was like, wow, like, this feels like it could have been on an EST record from about 7-8 years ago. Is that conscious? Like, is that someone you listened to or that you guys talked about or, you know, factored into?
Definitely in the early days. I mean, for Chris particularly, the Esbjørn Svendsen Trio was what first made him want to, because he wanted to be a classical pianist. But he loved, like, a lot of electronica stuff. But, like, when he first heard EST, that was the sort of turning point that made him want to do a band and a trio. So it's very much for him, but for all of us as well. Yeah, they were, I mean, there was nobody else really like them at the time, and they were very, very inspirational and sort of forward-thinking with what they did. I mean, we try not to reference them consciously, but people still say that we, you know, what we're doing sounds like them, and you can only take that as a huge compliment, really.
Right. The interview that I read, you were also apparently about to work on, or had maybe debuted, a live score to Koyaanisqatsi.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That I'm was, curious. In terms of that experience and working on something like that, do you feel that it's prepared you going forward in terms of your own sort of creations for Go-Go Penguin? Like, do you feel like this is something outside of what you normally do, or it could be part of like a larger whole of like Nick as a musician?
Well, I think that project was something that we were invited to do. It was for it was the opening of like an art house sort of cinema and theatre space and a great arts venue in Manchester called Home, and they were getting Manchester bands to do soundtracks for silent films. And it was something that Rob particularly had always wanted to do. Like, he's been fascinated with Koyaanisqatsi for years. So we kind of jokingly said, oh, we'll do that. And then they somehow got the rights. So it's like, okay, we've got to do this now. And it was a great thing. It's a slightly different way of working, of writing, because you're having to think about scenes, camera changes, and it was a lot of work we put in. You know, we needed to create like a click track and have lots of cues for different scene changes and when the music changes. So it's definitely good. I mean, we'd like to get into film scores and stuff in the future. And it was a lot of work, but yeah, it was.
Well, it makes sense because
definitely
your music is cinematic, so it certainly makes sense to think that you guys could do scoring. Going forward,
yeah.
I was just curious about, you know, like, do you feel like kind of hemmed in because there's like someone else's images and you have to match that timing versus, you know, when you're in the studio, you don't have to consider that thing. You might have a picture or a visual in your head, but it's not like set in stone that, like, you know, you have to pivot here or hit this mark.
Yeah. I mean, it's a different thing. You're kind of making music just for, you know, like, the sake of making music when you're making albums. I mean, it's the music stands upon its own, but yeah, it is a slightly different thing when you write into a film. But we're really proud of what we did for that, and it was a good project.
Right on. Nick, before we go, I want to get you to pick a track off the latest record that we can play for listeners. And if you have a reason why you're picking it or an anecdote about the song, I'd love to hear that.
Okay. I think I'll go with Transient State. This is it's an idea that Chris started with, and he was sort of inspired by a trip to Tokyo. And me and him had a day out, and we went to see some temples and various things around Tokyo and had a great day, and it kind of inspired this tune, and we were working on it, especially the main section, for ages, trying to figure out what the right thing to do with the bass was and the drums, and eventually it was like the bass and the piano playing the cross rhythm and the drums sort of playing this crazy thing. And I don't know, I think it's a real leap forward for us and one of the standout tracks on the album.
All right, well, we will give them one a listen. Go-Go Penguin playing the Weston Cultural Center as part of the Jazz Winnipeg Festival June 24th. That's a Sunday. Nick, thanks very much for taking some time out of your day to talk about the record, and very much looking forward to seeing you at the festival.
Thanks very much. Looking forward to the gig.